This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Greg Shupak about his recent article in Jacobin magazine, The Logic of Israeli Violence. For Shupak, the campaign of the Israelis against the Palestinian people is no less than an ethnocide, similar to the colonial settler project that America or Canada undertook against its native population. In a special issue of the Independent Socialist Magazine Monthly Review, attorney Michael Tiger has written an article entitled "The National Security State, the End of Separation of Powers."
The executive is supposed to be answerable to the courts. That's rarely been the case. First when it came to Indians, then slaves, and now with detentions and torture. It's an executive run wild.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
This is a solemn day in American history. As we record today, August 6th, 2014, we're reminded that this is the 69th anniversary of the American dropping of two bombs on Japan. The first, 69 years ago today, on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, killing several hundred thousand women, children, and old men, and then for good measure dropping a second bomb on the Japanese city of Nagasaki, killing 70,000 more Japanese. The pretext for this mass murder, the first time the atomic bomb was ever used, and the only times it was ever used, was that it would save American lives. American propaganda pointed to the large cost of lives of American soldiers, Army and mainly Marines, in the nearby island of Okinawa. My father was a Marine, fought in Okinawa, was badly wounded and sent home. And the United States pointed to the heavy casualties in Okinawa for the reasons for dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It would save American lives. It would cause the Japanese to surrender and negate any necessity for American troops to land in Japan. Well, the Japanese indeed surrendered right after the dropping of the bomb. But the truth has come out, most pointedly in the first scholarly book. There have been many others since then. The first book by Harvard professor Gar Alperowitz, called Atomic Diplomacy, documented the real reasons for the United States dropping the two bombs on Japanese civilians. And the real reasons were not to negate Americans having to fight in Japan. In fact, the United States knew that the Japanese were already suing for peace. They had intercepted communications that the Japanese had made with the Russians. The real reason was to warn the Russians that they better not interfere with the United States' plans in the post-World War II era, that they better not try to aid any popular movements that would challenge capitalism globally. The dropping of the two bombs was, in effect, a huge shot in the ongoing Cold War that was only suspended temporarily when the United States was allied with Russia from 1941 to 1945. It was only suspended. It heated up shortly after. Heated up to the point that by 1991, the United States had rolled back any of the remnants of the anti-capitalist socialist revolution in Russia and had restored capitalism to Russia. That was the intent of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that was the result. You have now one superpower, armed to the teeth with atomic weapons, a superpower that has come very close to using them many times since. Israel's cruelty and violence against the Palestinian people in Gaza, in its Operation Protective Edge, is not a random campaign, but a strategic experiment in colonial management. As Greg Shupak explains in his recent article, The Logic of Israeli Violence, Shupak points out that the attacks on Palestinian civilians, the bombing of their medical infrastructure, fishing boats, wheat mills, power plants, schools, and mosques is part of a larger cultural ethnocide aimed to render the Palestinian people dependent. His article demonstrates that there is a measured plan of attack to systematically erase the historic memory of the Palestinian people and their society. We talked today with Greg Shupak, a writer, activist, and a PhD candidate at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, where he teaches media studies. Greg Shupak, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here.
Greg, I read your article, The Logic of Israeli Violence, in the latest issue of the quite excellent Jacobin magazine. And before I ask you that central question that you wrote about so well in your article, The Logic of Israeli Violence, I wanted to talk about what I believe are Israeli pretexts on what they say were the reasons for doing what they did, and dispense with those so we can cut to the chase. So let me first ask you about the various reasons that the Israelis gave for their attack on Gaza. One was the kidnapping and murder of the three Israeli teenage settlers, and then it became to defend against the rocket attacks, and then it shifted ground again to the need to destroy the tunnels. But I'd like you to address those three, what I believe are pretexts, before we get into the real logic of the Israeli violence. So what do you believe is wrong with the arguments that the Israelis raised? And then let's get into what we think the real reason is.
Okay, well, I mean, as to the first point, it's been pretty widely exposed, I think, by this point, that the kidnappings of the Israeli settler teens was in no way on orders from Hamas or connected to Hamas leadership. So in that sense, that argument for attacking Hamas, which is what the war on Gaza is allegedly about, although with a rate of killing 86% civilians, which is what the UN's figures show in their latest Office of for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs shows. With that kill rate, I don't think it's accurate to describe it as a war on Hamas. But for the moment, we'll sort of go with that. So that just simply breaks down. Hamas leadership is not connected to the teens. Another point that's worth noting is that's a relatively thin pretext for starting a war on Palestinians as a whole, given the routine violence that the Israeli state inflicts on Palestinians, whether that's through using them as human shields, which you can read about in, for example, reports put out by Breaking the Silence, an organization of former Israeli soldiers, or whether that's, you know, detaining, torturing children in Israeli military prisons without due process, or for that matter, if we want to look at the most recent events, we could say that it makes no particular sense to say that this sort of round of hostilities began with the disappearance and killing of the settler teens, when you could just as easily say, well, in May, we know that Israeli security forces killed two unarmed Palestinian teenagers at Nakba Day demonstrations. Human Rights Watch documented that. So those are some of the reasons why I don't think that the settler teens justification holds any water. Now, of course, we also know that there's good reason to believe, according to some reporting done by 97 magazine and Max Blumenthal's reporting, that the Israeli security forces knew quite perfectly well that the teens were almost certainly killed as soon as they were abducted, and yet they sort of carried on this charade of pretending that they could be rescued in some way, and that was just sort of used as an excuse to rampage through the West Bank.
Yeah, the Israeli government blocked any news coming out. They cynically didn't even tell the parents of these children. Let's get to the other two pretexts first before we cut to the meat of your article on Jacobin, and that is to stop the rocket fire from the Palestinians, and then the last pretext was to destroy the tunnels. What is your response to those two pretexts?
Sure. Okay, well, as to the rockets, I mean, the first point would be to say that by Israel's own admission, Hamas kept to the ceasefire for 19 months, I suppose it was, since the November-December 2012 flare-up in violence. So rocket fire from Hamas forces, anyway, did not start until after Israel was carrying out strikes within Gaza and carrying out various forms of killing Palestinian civilians and or people that it describes as militants. I mean, the rockets were a response to Israeli violence. So if Israeli violence begets the rockets, then it makes no sense to say that the Israeli violence is being enacted to stop the rocket fire. Furthermore, worth noting that as some legal experts have pointed out in recent weeks, John Dugard, for example, on Al Jazeera, as well as Noura Erekrat on Jadalaya, you know, these scholars have pointed out that this pretext, this idea of rockets creating a justification for attacking Gaza as a whole, or rather using military force to attack Gaza, this is not supported by international law. Israel is an occupying power, and hence it does not have the right to use military force to repress resistance. Erekrat discusses this in more detail in the Jadalaya article, so I would encourage readers to look, or listeners, I should say, to look at that.
Yeah, John Dugard is the former UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Palestine, and you're talking about Noura Erekrat, the international law expert.
Yes.
Let's go to the last pretext, the tunnels, before we get into the meat of your Jacobin article. The Israelis, towards the end of their campaign, said that they were doing this to destroy the tunnels that the Palestinians had dug under Gaza City. And how do you evaluate that claim?
I guess one point that's worth noting is that the Israeli propaganda has claimed that, you know, these tunnels, well, I suppose they've insinuated that these tunnels have in fact been used to kill Israeli civilians, or that they may well be, but that just simply has not happened. The tunnels may or have been used in cases of resistance against Israeli military forces, but we know that that type of resistance is legitimate for Palestinians, as they are unoccupied people. So there's no basis for claiming that these tunnels pose some kind of clear and present danger to Israeli civilians. Another point that's worth mentioning is if you look at a report put out by Doctors Without Borders, its plea that was titled Israel Must Stop Bombing Trapped Civilians, they said that while official claims that the, I'm quoting here, while official claims that the objective of the ground offensive is to destroy tunnels into Israel, what we see on the ground is that bombing is indiscriminate and that those who die are civilians. In other words, Israel is not conducting itself in a way that suggests its objective is destroying the tunnels. Rather, it is engaging in, as the quote says, indiscriminate violence. Another point I'd make on this is, and this is in a blog on the London Review of Books the other day, okay, when the Egyptian coup took place in 2013, the Sisi regime undertook destroying a lot of the tunnels between Egypt and Gaza, and this regime, the Egyptian regime, is believed to have wiped out roughly 1,000 tunnels without killing anyone in a fairly short period of time, whereas by contrast, according to the article, there seem to have been no more than 40 tunnels from Gaza into Israel, and the operation to supposedly destroy them has already taken over, I suppose it was over 2 weeks since the ground invasion. And furthermore, as we know, there's been a tremendous loss of life. So if the aim was to destroy tunnels, Egypt, which is being ruled by a brutal regime in its own right, was able to get rid of these tunnels without killing huge numbers of civilians.
We're speaking with Greg Shupak, a writer and activist and PhD candidate at the University of Guelph in Canada, who's written an excellent article in the current issue of Jacobin magazine called The Logic of Israeli Violence. Greg, if we can then dispose of these pretexts as you so ably did, let's talk about the real reason. You write that there's an underlying logic to Israeli violence, and you talk about what that logic is and what the Israelis are really trying to do. And I would like you to address yourself to that central question.
Sure. I should say that my analysis on that issue was pretty directly informed by two thinkers who have looked at this, Daryl Lee and Bashir Abu Maneh, and in general, my analysis of this of these issues is informed by a huge range of Palestinian thinkers and ordinary civilians and human rights groups and so on, as well as the Palestine Solidarity Movement more generally. What I argue in the article is essentially grows from a point that Lee makes about Israeli policy towards Gaza more generally, and that is that, to quote Lee, Israel's aim vis-a-vis Gaza is to, quote, isolate Palestinians there from the outside world, render them utterly dependent on external benevolence, and at the same time absolve Israel of responsibility toward them. In much the same vein, Bashir Abu Maneh argues that Israel's main objective has consistently been to, quote, maintain Jewish supremacy in Palestine, as much land as possible, as few Palestinians as possible. Okay, so now taking those two arguments, the sort of thesis I put forth about the current violence in Operation Protective Edge is that one way Israel is attempting to achieve that goal of Jewish supremacy in historic Palestine with as much land as possible and as few Palestinians as possible, one way Israel has pursued that goal is to aim to obliterate Palestinians as a people with the capacity to live independently in their homeland. So, yeah, the focus of the article is that. It is how the, I suppose you could say, pattern of Israeli violence during Protective Edge, and I think it applies to more generally a lot of Israeli conduct, is to not only kill and maim Palestinians, but to impede their capacity to live autonomously in historic Palestine.
Let's flesh that claim out and talk about what precisely the Israelis have done with respect to hospitals, schools, mosques, homes, governmental offices, the whole of civil society that the Palestinians have managed to build up in Gaza. Talk to us specifically about the damage done to the infrastructure of Gaza, not just the people, not just the 1,850 people killed or the 400 children killed or the many thousands wounded, but let's talk about what they've done to Gaza as a whole in support of your claim that they're trying to do to the Palestinian people what, say, the was done to the Native Americans in my country or the Native Americans in your country. Talk about specifically what was done to the Palestinian infrastructure.
Sure. That's an important point about the parallels to the indigenous populations of the Americas, that this is the sort of framework in which I think Israel needs to be understood. It's a settler colonial project. And you can see that in terms of the what are often called Bantustans, in which sort of Palestinians are being cordoned off into. These very much resemble native reserves in Canada and the United States. Anyway, to speak to the specific questions that you asked, it's important to recognize that, again, this is part of a longer-term pattern. So if you look at the work of someone like Dr. Sarah Roy of Harvard, she has documented extensively what she calls the deliberate de-development of the Gaza Strip's economy. And in fact, she's recently warned that unless funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, has increased, Gazans are at risk of mass starvation. So that's sort of the framework in which this is taking place, Operation Protective Edge. So this has caused sort of a health catastrophe, as you've noted. So we've seen, for example, attacks on paramedics. So the Doctors Without Borders call for Israel to relax its offensive, documented, for instance, the attacks on paramedics. As of the latest numbers put forth by the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the OCHA, that is, UN organization, 5 hospitals have been shut down, 24 health facilities have been damaged. We know also that there's been direct strikes on hospitals as well, direct strikes from Israeli fire. So the ability of Palestinians to care for themselves and for each other has very much been undermined. Now, this is not just limited to health by any means. I was mentioning the economy of Gaza. Well, the last numbers I saw, 2/3 of Gaza's wheat mills are inoperative. 3,000 of its herders are in need of animal feed. We've seen fishermen attacked. We've seen attacks on agricultural sites. These are all part of that process that Sarah Roy has talked about in the longer term. These are all ways of preventing Palestinians from being able to provide for themselves, economically speaking. And, I mean, the whole Gaza siege that's been going on since Hamas came to power, more specifically since the attempted coup against Hamas was foiled, this siege has also dramatically increased the unemployment rate in Gaza and made the population dependent on aid. So I see, again, an intensification of that during Operation Protective Edge.
There's the destruction of the power plants, so there's very little electricity. There's no clean water. And just in terms of cultural institutions, 83 mosques were attacked. 133 schools were attacked. What does it mean to destroy schools and mosques in terms of perpetuating a culture?
The role that mosques would play in communities there is similar to what I think religious institutions play in any community, in that this is these are physical spaces where people come together to interact, to forge bonds, to care for each other by providing for the needy, and so on. So religion is one of the major ways in which a cultural group understands its identity. Then attacking the institutions of that religion are sort of ipso facto an attack on the capacity of that people to have an identity.
And you make the point that attacking religious institutions is a feature of colonial settler states generally.
Sure.
What was done in Australia, America, Canada, taking children, for example, and putting them in schools and forbidding them to speak their native language.
Precisely. I think this is definitely a form of that. So in Canada, we had residential schools, which had the purpose was described as being to sort of take what they called take the Indian out of the child, right? So these were Christian organizations that were there specifically to eradicate various Aboriginal cultures. And consequently, they also became quite violent. Children were abused physically, sexually, and psychologically in all kinds of ways. So blowing up mosques, I think, is a very closely related manifestation of it. You mentioned the schools damaged, and I think that's similar. So as of the most recent numbers, 141 schools damaged in Gaza. When you attack an educational institution, you're undermining the ability of a people to educate their young, to train them for future work, to teach them to think critically, to develop artists and inventors and so on. Okay, this to me is a very significant way of stifling a particular cultural group's independent existence.
You wrote in your Jacobin article that the Israelis aim to obliterate Palestinian people as a people with a capacity to live independently in their own homeland. And then you use the phrase that the Israelis use called mowing the lawn. We can remind our listeners that this is the third time since 2008 that they've mowed the lawn. And my question is, we understand that this is a way to control Palestine and to defeat these people's resistance. But I want to talk about the relationship between the United States and in its interests and why it supports the Israelis in what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. Why is the suppression of Palestinian resistance crucial to how the United States operates in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's crucial for a variety of reasons, and some of those have shifted over time. But, I mean, at its simplest level, I mean, the State of Israel can, in effect, be thought of as among other things, being sort of a giant military base for the United States. So this is an outpost from which the United States can intervene in various parts of the Middle East, however and whenever it sort of sees fit or sees useful.
Noam Chomsky compares Israel to an American aircraft carrier. He says it even has the same shape as an aircraft carrier parked right there in the Middle East.
Well, yeah, that's, I suppose, a similar kind of... and I think that's very much a part of what's at play here. I quote in the article a scholar I've mentioned a couple times, Bashir Abu Maneh, and he says, he describes sort of a cycle which is at work, which is basically that American policymakers believe an alliance with Israel helps the U.S. control the Middle East, so the United States enables Israeli colonialism and occupation, and that in turn creates contexts for further U.S. interventions in the region that can then in turn be used to try to deepen American hegemony. So, in other words, you know, Israel continues its process of colonization. People, whether that's in historic Palestine or in other cases, like, for instance, Lebanon, object to this, whether these are displaced Palestinians or, in some cases, just sympathetic allies. And this, you know, is a major factor in shaping the Middle East and keeping it largely unstable. And one aspect of that is that it creates a context in which it's sort of permissible, I suppose, at least from the standpoint of American policymakers, to keep tyrants in place who can maintain what they call order and use that as a grounds for ensuring that these states fall in line with U.S. dictates. So, I mean, certainly Egypt is a major example of that.
I wanted to conclude with another question for you. We didn't speak, but we should have mentioned that the event that preceded the Israeli attack on Gaza was the unity government that Hamas had hammered out with the Palestinian Authority. And Hamas had agreed when joining that government that they would end the violence, that they would recognize Israel, and that they would support a two-state solution. And it was with that unity government in place that the Israelis then responded with this huge attack on the West Bank, the arrest of hundreds of Hamas figures. They really torpedoed that unity government. So my final question to you, Greg, is where do you see things going from here? More mowing lawns?
I think that's, at this point, what Israel is seeking. Muin Rabbani had a useful sort of analysis of this on the Middle East Institute for Understanding the other day, so I'd encourage listeners to look at that. So, yeah, no, I think a return to the status quo of May, let's say, is what Israel is seeking. I'm not sure that it'll work out that way. I think the terrain is too unsettled to make that judgment at this point, but I think very much one of the reasons to attack the unity government is because Israel benefits immensely, for old-fashioned colonial reasons, by keeping the Palestinians divided. And the idea of a unified, albeit perhaps with discordant factions and whatnot, but a at least somewhat unified Palestinian leadership is, terrified Israel, and I think that's a major, major factor in what set off this this recent round of horrific violence.
Well, Greg Shupak, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. You're the author of an excellent article in this month's Jacobin magazine called The Logic of Israeli Violence. We refer our listeners to that article. We appreciate your being on the show, and we look forward to working with you in the future in solidarity with the Palestinians. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today with retired law professor Michael E. Tiger, used to teach law at Duke University. He has written an article titled The National Security State, The End of Separation of Powers for the July-August 2014 issue of the Independent Socialist Magazine Monthly Review. It's a special issue called Surveillance Capitalism, and Michael has written about how the executive branch of the government has come to dominate both the judicial and the legislative branches. Michael Tiger is the Emeritus Professor of Law at Duke University and Emeritus Professor of Law at Washington College of Law. He's been a lawyer working on social change issues for many years. His books include Law and the Rise of Capitalism, Fighting Injustice, and Thinking About Terrorism, the Threat to Civil Liberties in Times of National Emergency. Michael Tiger, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Michael, you wrote a very important article in this month's Monthly Review, the July-August 2014 issue of Monthly Review. The whole issue, edited by John Mage, is called Surveillance Capitalism. And you wrote the concluding article entitled The National Security State, The End of Separation of Powers. And we want to talk to you about that, and I just think the best way to approach is just ask you generally, what is the point that you're trying to make in the article?
Well, the basic principle of constitutional government as established in our Constitution is that the actions of the legislative and executive branches, and particularly the executive branch, are always reviewable by independently appointed judges, and that the legality of whatever the executive branch does that harms any protected interest of any citizen or otherwise ought to be reviewable in the courts of the United States. That was the principle that Chief Justice Marshall laid down in Marbury versus Madison, which every school person knows, and that he reaffirmed when he sat as trial judge in the trial of Aaron Burr.
Well, now we have the judiciary not reviewing questions of torture, surveillance, detention, targeted killings. How did we get to where we started off in the Constitution and where we are now?
The most disappointing thing about this is that the harm to the judicial branch is, in a real sense, a self-inflicted wound. That is to say that judges confronted with assertions of executive power have proven inadequate to the task of restraining exercises of executive power. Now, that's not the first time this has happened in American history. We recall the massive illegality of the Japanese relocation at the beginning of the Second World War. And it has now been shown that the premise upon which that relocation took place, confining Japanese Americans in concentration camps, was false. And the Supreme Court of the United States docilely upheld that relocation. Not until 50 years later did the courts finally come around. So what we see here, and what I point out in the article, is that at the time the Constitution was being debated, Patrick Henry, whose name everybody knows, opposed the adoption of the Constitution on the ground that the idea that the independent judiciary could act as an effective check upon the exercise of executive power, particularly military power, was bound to be disproven in history. What if your president should arrive, he said, at the court, at the head of his army? Will Mr. Chief Justice make him give bail? And so that warning that Patrick Henry uttered in the Virginia Convention, as I point out in the article, turned out to be true.
Yeah.
I have a question, Michael. Let's go back to the beginning, although Michael wants you to go forward with what's happening now. But when you talked about these principles in the article, I thought your view about American law, or law in a bourgeois system, was really interesting. Because on one level, it gives individuals a lot in terms of their rights, at least in the black letter law. And on occasion, it's enforced, but oftentimes it's not. And you've given us some illustrations about this. Can you talk to us for a second about how you think law operates in the system we're in terms of that issue?
Well, law is legal ideology. That is to say, it is erected around a system of social relations. And in every time in courted history, there is a sense in which the formal guarantees that rules of law make about individual rights are simply lies the regime tells the people in order to sustain itself. That was the burden of a book that I wrote called Law and the Rise of Capitalism, which has now been translated into a lot of languages. And every once in a while, somebody calls me up and says, oh, that's what happened. So that it is not unusual. And of course, the idea that you rally people to the cause of social change by promising them liberty is also not new. No sooner had the people of France been the shock troops that overthrew the French monarchy than the National Assembly met and reinstituted the institution of slavery, forbade labor organizations from operating, and indeed got terribly worried about the fact that women were going to assert their rights, and so said something quite ugly about that. So the notion that the American Revolution and that great constitutional change should turn out in the end to have these disappointments shouldn't surprise us. And in the article I point out that the first two major victims of this kind of paltering in a double sense were the Native Americans in a case called Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, and then, of course, the Dred Scott decision in which the Supreme Court said that black men had no rights that a white man need respect. A thought that we think of as particularly ugly, but since then President-elect Buchanan knew it was about to be said, he thought that once the Supreme Court said that, the issue of slavery would be settled.
Well, eventually it was, but not through that decision. Michael, elaborate a little bit on the Native Americans. They had numerous nations in this country which were obliterated. How did the bourgeois courts of the United States treat the Native American nations? Did they treat them truly as nations?
No. The Cherokee people of Georgia read the Constitution, and they said, aha, the Constitution guarantees that any group or individual can exercise certain social rights. And so they drafted a constitution for their nation, and they set up institutions, and then they brought suit against the state of Georgia to enforce these rights that the letter of the American Constitution guaranteed them. And what did Chief Justice Marshall say? He said, oh, wait a minute. These are inferior and subject people. When the Constitution gives a right to all people, persons, citizens, whatever, to bring lawsuits under Article 3 and to bring them to us. It wasn't talking about these people.
Let me follow up on your observation that the judiciary has inflicted a wound upon itself and ask you about the legislature. What happened when Senator Feinstein tried to investigate the CIA? Talk to us about that.
Well, I started the article with that because it's so telling. That is, we are told that if the judicial branch doesn't want to enter into evaluating what the executive branch is doing, that surely the legislature will be a check upon this. And so the Senate Intelligence Committee began an investigation of the CIA. In charge of that, largely, was Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is, by the way, a friend of what's called the Intelligence Committee.
Yes.
She found that the CIA and its lawyers lied, attempted to withhold documents, conducted what, in those of us who are, you know, remember the Watergate call, massive stonewalling and cover-up. So that even the effort by the legislative branch, the super secret Senate Intelligence Committee, that's not even a branch, that's a little twig out at the end, to oversee the intelligence services, was doomed to fail. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is that, first of all, we ought to have expected it. That is to say that having in the wake of the Second World War created the CIA and a whole paramilitary apparatus devoted to lying, cheating, assassination, and overthrowing democratically elected governments, what would we expect? That they would say, oh, yes, by the way, come in and find out what we're doing and regulate us. No, that's not happening.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing I want to make clear is that, Michael Ratner, you and others, courageous lawyers, who have been struggling to get reviewability of unlawful executive action, should not give up the fight. That is to say, although your voice may not carry in a particular case, the kinds of efforts that you make deserve support and turn out in historical terms to be important.
Michael, I appreciate that, but of course, as you know, and your article articulates in incredibly powerful form, what a failure in post 9/11. I mean, what a complete failure. As you said, you know, we've gone to court a zillion times about torture in every variety we've had. We did win so-called some review in Guantanamo, which has not been given any effect at all, none. And now the Supreme Court has sat on its hands while the circuit court completely demolishes our Guantanamo cases. I mean, it's been, you know, an exercise in incredible futility and being wound up taking all this energy from hundreds of lawyers doing this. I appreciate your saying it had to be done. Of course it had to be done. But my gosh.
You know, in 1988, Michael, I went to South Africa, and there I saw the apartheid regime in full cry. I was working with members of the African National Congress, the Black Lawyers Association, and I saw these lawyers who for 30 years had been working against the apartheid regime and had not given up hope, even in a society in which to even possess and read a book by Nelson Mandela was against the law. And then in 1989, I went back again, and I met with Dulla Omar, Mandela's lawyer, and he said, we're going to bring the government to a halt. And we're going to get Mandela out. And I said, oh, yeah, sure you are. Well, they did it. And as Albie Sachs said, all revolutions are impossible till they happen. Then they become inevitable. Now, it's true that the majority of the South African population was conscious of its oppression. You know, 2/3 of the people in that country were black. And as Robin Williams has said, gee, does the name Custer mean anything to them? The point is that we just don't know what's going to happen. Historically, the role of lawyers has been to articulate people's claims for justice. And even in the process of testing those claims for justice against the established order, to help get the message out there as to just how fragile the system review is, and to get people thinking, gee, maybe it needs to be changed.
I have a question for you, because this is probably the next book you ought to write. Lawyer Bill Kunstler, I know you knew very well, was going to write this book before he died. He never did. But maybe this is good for you to write, speaking of lawyers, because if we look at what happened to lawyers who were frustrated by the system in the way we're all frustrated. You look at Mandela, Maurice Bishop of Grenada, Fidel of Cuba, Gandhi of India. In the end, they didn't all pick up the weapon. Some of them did passive nonviolence. But essentially, they stopped using the legal system. So the question for you is, when do we stop using the legal system?
Well, the last chapter of or two of Law and the Rise of Capitalism has some thoughts about that. And I think that's an interesting discussion to have. You know, I finished the draft of my article, and I sent it off to my friend, Lord Justice Sedley, who's a retired appeals judge in the United Kingdom, Stephen Sedley. And Lord Justice Sedley writes back and says, take a look at page 15 of the Oxford lecture I gave a month ago. And it said the same thing.
Which is? Say what it said.
That in the so-called democratic countries, the so-called intelligence apparatus has escaped the control of the ordinary institutions of government. Is Lord Justice Sedley, who wrote an opinion in a case in which I was counsel, in which the Blair government had taken the position that the Queen of England, acting by order in council, was an absolute monarch, not subject to judicial review. And Lord Justice Sedley wrote, not so fast there, Your Majesty. You know, we did something to monarchs that had said that before.
Starting with Charles, which is where your article starts, we're speaking with Michael Tiger, really one of the great lawyers of our generation. He has an article in this month's monthly review called The National Security State, The End of Separation of Powers. Michael, I'd like to ask you about two of the cases that you cite in your article, which are really two of the controlling and profound cases of recent times, one regarding Padilla and the other Alawaki. Could you tell our listeners about those two cases and how utterly disappointing the judiciary was when it considered the issues in those cases?
Well, Padilla or Padilla was being held under charged with ordinary crimes. He is held under circumstances that amount to torture, and is held indeed under circumstances that don't even amount to civilian confinement. And there, the court simply defers to the executive branch. Now, the Alawaki case is an attempt to get some judicial review of some kind with respect to the use of drones to kill civilians who happen to be United States citizens based on intelligence conclusions made by people in the White House. Now, what unites these cases, and you can read about them in detail, are two things. First of all, the executive branch is suspending the ordinary processes by which we always thought the so-called criminal justice system should work, the system that calls itself justice. That is to say, the system of judging people guilty or not guilty of crimes, of giving them access to counsel, of holding them under humane conditions if bail is to be denied pending their trials. Padilla says, no, maybe that is not really supposed to go on. You probably don't have to do that under these circumstances. And to do that by calling people enemy combatants instead of criminal defendants. Alawaki takes it a step further. First of all, the administration resisted until quite recently, when ordered by a court, to even let everybody know the so-called legal basis upon which drones were to operate. And then second, for the last, well, ever since I was in high school, I've been concerned about the operation of the system of capital punishment. And at least finally we got the Supreme Court of the United States to say death was different enough so that if you wanted to kill somebody, execute them for having done a crime in the past, that you would have a fair trial and you would have separate consideration, the reasoned moral response to the mitigating and aggravating evidence, and so on. The Alawaki case simply says that the executive decides to abandon that idea and to find that and to decide that X or Y or Z, some citizen who's overseas, is violating or is about to violate or has violated some vaguely defined set of legal rules that might make them dangerous, that we have the right to kill them. Not only do we have the right to kill them, But since an enormous percentage, maybe 30, 35% of these drone strikes also take out a bunch of civilians, as to whom there is no allegation at all they did anything wrong, we have the right to kill him and whoever else happens to be standing by. So let's look at this, what a kind of departure this is. First, the mechanism by which we determine who is worthy of punishment and who is not, fundamentally flawed. The terrible thing there is that Attorney General Holder goes to Northwestern University Law School, in a law school, and says that the people like Al Awlaki, they get due process.
It's amazing. What was the due process? The due process is we considered it.
Yeah, well, that we paused for a moment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is, so suppose you think killing people is okay, right? The idea that you would call that due process, the idea that an African-American attorney general would call that due process is revolting. And the second thing is that the so-called legal justification for all of this simply rests upon some ill-defined idea about executive power. And as I begin my article by pointing out, we don't even get judicial review of whether or not to kill somebody. We even have to fight for judicial review of finding out the rules by which they want to kill somebody. In short, all notions of accountability are out the window. That's disturbing to me.
Yeah, I'll say. You sum it up with three words, Michael. You call it a no-law zone. And
that's right. Well, that's what it is. It is a no-law zone. I mean, think about this. What Edward Snowden and Julius Assange have done is to reveal to the world fundamental defects in the way that the American political society has been operating. And yet, rather than say thank you in any form or other, the government is hell-bent on prosecuting them, on overriding every kind of legal protection that they could possibly have. You know, Sammy the Bull Gravano, he's a mafiosi, he killed 21 people. We gave him immunity. Why? Because he says, Sammy, you've identified a serious social problem. But no such discussions are had. And the other thing, of course, is let us ask ourselves, how dangerous to American people are the environmental polluters? How many people will die of cancer as a result of the Fukushima plant meltdown in the ensuing years? You know what? More than Al-Qaeda will kill, I'll tell you that. And yet we are not taking out the top management of the Fukushima, you know, the electric company in Japan with drones.
Well, Michael, we're running to the end of this, but I so appreciate your pulling over, doing it from your car. The article I again want to recommend, we've been speaking to Michael Tiger, it's called The National Security State, The End of Separation of Powers. It's in the special edition on surveillance capitalism in the July-August 2014 issue of Monthly Review. It's a fantastic article. And Michael Tiger, once again, thank you for being with us and encouraging us to still pick up law books.
MonthlyReview.org. We'll have it online, the whole issue, pretty soon.
We'll link to that, Michael. Thank you so much for being on the show.
You bet.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.